Hello and welcome to another podcast of Peter Hill Explains, where I delve into things scientific. This is part of my cardiac rehabilitation, so I talk while I'm walking, and it's also rehabilitating my ability to explain things after a while out of the business. Now, I've decided to look at things scientific, and rather than delve into the standard scientific fare, the whiz-bang stuff, I've looked at the things that led to science. So if you can imagine you're in a house and you're trying to work out why things were put in a particular way, it's good to know the people who originally lived in the house or what they were thinking, how they were trying to build things. So this is true for science. The people who occupied the territory that scientists now occupy used to be the philosophers, and a lot of what they did and why they did it is to do with history. So that's why I've looked at the ancient Greeks, and there's certainly a large number of colourful characters in there, and a lot of them are quite successful, but not for the reasons that you would think. They're successful because they were good at their job, at putting things out, but they put them out in play form, that is, in serials that people could understand, plays and poems, they were required by the culture at the time. Those people who had some quite good ideas, but they didn't actually fit into the cultural needs, had some quite good ideas, but these didn't progress forward. And people have sort of gone forward without questioning what they're doing. But this time I'm going to look at our nearest neighbour, the sun, because I'm teaching this at school, and there's a little bit to understand about it. So you get your regular fare. So you have your naive fare. This is stuff you learn just from people talking about it. The sun's coming up today. So you get the still naive impression that the sun is actually orbiting the Earth. And you get pictures of it in books. Then at school you learn a little bit more, and I'm trying to actually extend you a little bit further than what you would probably learn at school. So you'll learn that the sun generates heat and it's very hot and bright and we orbit around it. You might go a bit deeper into it. So this particular program is trying to actually get you into the actual astrophysics, the stellar mechanics, some plasma physics, which are quite easy to understand. And there's some traps which have been laid in there. People have not really bothered to clean it up. Sort of like a bedroom or a playroom where things have been left a little bit awry, and you'll have to walk across it without tripping over. And some people have left a few ideas not quite where they should be, so it's quite hard for someone who doesn't have a guide actually to work out what's going on. So one of the first things people have explained to them is that the sun is very big and very far away. Now this is a bit hard because both the sun and the moon occupy exactly one half a degree in the sky. Now they can look quite big when they're actually at half degrees against another object, but they're pretty much the same angular width across. Now the distance to both these objects are far, but they're not incomprehensible. And I hope you do understand your fundamental length, the length between your two outstretched hands, or your actual height. It could be anywhere between a meter and 2 meters. Now the meter is an interesting unit of measure because it's actually linked to the diameter of the Earth. Now it's not a fraction of the diameter of the Earth. Question, not the diameter of the circumference. It's not a fraction of the circumference of the Earth, but only just. When it was first being defined, or people having a stab at it, they said that there were 10,000 kilometers, 10 million meters between the pole and the equator running through, let me guess, where were the people who were organizing it running through none other no other place than Paris, not through London, Greenwich Mean Time, no, but switched off a little bit across through Paris. Now, this is okay, but the Earth's not a sphere. It's not a very good sphere or good enough for working out meters. And so we've got other units now. In terms of now, a meter is defined by how far light will travel in the velocity of one on the velocity of light seconds. So this is a fraction of a second. So we've actually removed the definition of a meter and linked it to the speed of light and time. But getting back to it, so there's 40,000 kilometers going if you want to start at one point and you walk in one line, you'll be back to where you were after 40,000 kilometers. So you can set out in any direction and get back to where you are. Now, if you think of it in your car, you'll be quite happy to have a car which has got 40,000 kilometers on the clock. If it's got 320,000 kilometers on the clock, that's gone a fair distance. But that distance, which is 8 times around the Earth, is the actual distance from here to the Moon. Now, I'm not going to go into the calculations because they're often hard to do in your head when you're walking. But the Moon, the distance between the Earth and the Moon, and the Earth and the Sun, that's roughly 500. So the Sun's a fair distance away, but it's not an incredibly far distance away. And so we're going to look at the Sun and have a few thoughts about it. What what determines the temperature of the Sun, the temperature of the surface of the Sun? Now, it gives me great anxiety, disappointment when people teach high school physics and they say, oh, look at the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, that all stars have a certain temperature associated with its size, and the size causes the temperature. So large suns are very hot, and they actually glow blue. We'll go into it. The color of the Sun is related to the temperature of the Sun. So the initial idea is that the color and temperature of the Sun is related to the size of the Sun. Now, this is happens to be true because of some underlying astrophysics, and that's what we'll get to. But firstly, I'll have to take a backtrack and actually look at color and temperature. Now, obviously, people just accepted that stars with some different colours. You can see a few blue stars, a few yellow, a few very distinctively reddish stars, and people just accepted them as slightly different colours. One of the colours you won't see, of course, I say of course, is green. Green is not a colour that you get by putting an iron in a fire. It doesn't glow green at any temperature. And essentially, this is what is the colour of suns, because they are stars. Our star is actually called the star Sol, S-O-L, for its name. Our nearest star is Alpha Centauri. So they've got star names, but we call our local star a common name of the Sun. And their colour is related to how hot they are. Now, it took a little while to actually put this temperature and heat, the temperature and the colour of something, into a standard form. And the story goes, and I think this is true, it sounds pretty true to me, that getting the temperature right was very, very important for all making pottery. And the Wedgwoods, who were stealing these methods of making pottery from China to make cheap rip-offs of Chinese pottery in England. So this is rather strange. You think of China making rip-offs of Western stuff back in the day, England was making rip-offs of Chinese pottery. But to get the pottery absolutely right, particularly bone china, which is actually made out of a clay made from bones, very thin, translucent stuff, the witchwoods had a magic trick. They had no thermometers for these great temperatures, but they realised that a certain colour, yellow or orange or bright white, told you how hot the furnace was. So they were able to set their temperatures exact for the right time and actually guide the formation of the clay into the pottery. Now, clay, amazingly, is not a particular material. Clay refers to basically a size of particle. So you've got pebbles, sand, and clay. Clay refers to nanoparticles, and what happens in pottery is that your nanoparticles sweat and produce a glassy layer, glassy matrix. So your pottery is really sort of very fine artificial sandstone or mixed with glass. So the metal impurities with the clay come to the surface and form a frit and form a pottery. But getting back to the most important point here is that they worked out that the colour of a particular object is determined or tells you the temperature of that object, which is very important for telling the temperature of our sun. So our sun's a particular temperature, and people will tell you it's because it's a particular size. And as we get through into this and explore, we realise it's slightly different. And to give you a sneak preview, imagine that you have an iron taken out of the blacksmith's forge, and it initially goes quite hot, but you leave it out for a little while and there's a scale which forms on it, it blacks up. You can see it's glowing underneath. Now, you know it's hot underneath, and if you actually remove that scale, knock it off with your hammer, it glows brightly again. That's indeed what happens with suns. The actual temperature of the sun is how much of that sun has been knocked off, removed, to reveal the inner temperature. And the inner temperature of the sun, right in the center, is 15 million degrees. And I think this is about the time to actually... So I'm just going up a hill here, and with this cardiac condition, I'm just having to slow down a tiny amount. So the center or core of our sun is 15 million degrees. It goes all the way up, out, slowly reducing in temperature till it's around 5,000 degrees or white hot. You know, white hot, that's why it's colored white. And then something mysteriously happens. It doesn't continue to cool. It suddenly heats up again. And that allows us to see into the sun. So we're actually seeing a, X-ray vision. Oh, not an X-ray vision, but we actually see into the sun because the temperature at its lowest point is 5,000 degrees. It then increases as it goes towards us. And this is a bit hard to understand. But let's look at the sun itself. The sun is a big ball of helium and hydrogen. So it's one part helium and three parts hydrogen. That is, it's roughly 27% helium, and the rest is hydrogen. Now, you'd say, oh, well, it's majority of the mass of the sun is hydrogen. Well, that's incorrect, because each particle of helium, which has two neutrons and two protons, is actually four times heavier than each particle of hydrogen. So the sun by mass is actually mostly or nearly 50-50 helium and hydrogen. Now, the give you an overall guide to the sun, as a speaking one, the sun is a ball. Now, the reason that it is a ball or a sphere is due to gravity. That is, that's the lowest energy formation of something just pulling itself together. So you can imagine a spider or something curling itself up into a ball to make its surface as small, as tight as possible, or a small kid who's told to squeeze up into a corner and hide. So the sun is similar to that. It's actually pulling itself down. So if you can imagine if there was such a thing as a mountain, and there are tsunamis which rage around the sun, and a huge cyclones or tornadoes which go around the sun, and the earth could just fit neatly inside one of these tornadoes. So there's a lot of activity on the sun, but there's also great gravity, so pulling it into a sphere. So if there's anything tried to build up, it gets quickly pulled down into this beautiful surface layer. And you would know this leveling effect by just looking at a glass of water. You see the water is very flat on the surface. Or if you go out in a boat in the sea, you can see how beautifully smooth the sea is because it's all being pulled into a sphere by gravity. But getting back to the sun, we need some sort of way of think of our way into the sun. So the very center of the sun, so if we said there's 100 units, or select 100 units from the surface to the middle of the sun, from 0 to 20 is the core of the sun. So the middle 20% radius of the sun is the core. And people may know the core is where it's defined, where there is 99% of fusion. Now, fusion is our name for the nuclear reaction which actually generates the heat in the sun. Now, this generation of heat is not a violent nuclear explosion. It's actually at a rate similar to a compost heap. But it's a very few watts per basic ton of material. So you'd get that if you had a ton of compost. It would just warm up slightly. But this is a very big and angry compost heap that's producing a lot of heat. But this is in the middle 20% radius of the sun. And if you actually go down, that's 99%, where roughly, say, the halfway point, is that under 10%. Now, if you do the maths for radius to volume, you get something rather interesting. People are very used to squaring things for area, but for volume, you cube it. And so you get 0.1 times 0.1 times 0.1. You actually get 0.1% of the volume of the sun is involved in actually generating most of the energy. So it's right in the very center. This is a very dense section of the sun, and the actual pressure is such that the hydrogens, which is 50% of the mass, get pushed together. And when they get pushed together, eventually forming helium, this is a lower energy state. This releases heat and energy of the sun, and which is true for 99% of the way, or 99.5% of the way, of the energy is created in the sun. This is fusion. Now, one question is that in any process that you see around the place, if you have a fire, it generates smoke, and the smoke leaves, or your car, there's car exhaust. So if you've got this process, where is the waste product going? Well, the answer is that it's not going out into space, or a little of it's going into space. It's going into the core of the sun. So the exhaust of the sun is building up in the center of the sun. So the sun is changing composition over time. Now, if you've been listening to me carefully at this point in time, you'll see that I did say that 99, there's about 0.5% or a bit more than 0.5% of energy which is not due to this fusion. Now this fusion, this other 0.5% is really the interesting thing which is happening in the sun. So stars much bigger than the sun are predominantly by this process. So our sun's just beginning to play in the area of the CNO cycle. C for carbon, that's right. The sun actually produces a little bit of carbon, and this same fusion process building up. The weight of nucleuses increases and produces some nitrogen, and that nitrogen produces some oxygen. And I think the process goes around, so this process continues, it's called a cycle, and this is a very high energy, high efficiency cycle, and it's slowly increasing in time. And you're saying, oh, it's beginning to burn fuel a bit more efficiently, a bit more of it over time. Is the sun getting hotter? And indeed, the sun is gradually getting hotter. And this cycle is slowly increasing the temperature of the sun and slowly walking out the habitable zone of life around the sun. So this habitable zone is just about to leave the earth. The sun is about to get hot. So way before we get consumed by the sun will heat up and boil away all the water on earth, this process. So the sun is actually getting hotter as it ages. And this is what we do see, is that suns tend to actually get hotter and age. When you say hotter, the overall temperature output, the overall energy output increases. Now, as I said before, the actual temperature of the sun is to do with how much of the sun is pushed back and goes at its lowest temperature. We say it's the lowest temperature, and the temperature suddenly increases and the atmosphere suddenly thins on the surface. And this is what I really want to get to in this podcast, is that as you go up from the core, the material of the sun from 70 down to 20, where the core begins to right down to zero, is very benign, very quiet. There's no storms, nothing is happening. So if you're there, it would be absolutely still. So if you imagine a still lake on a day where there's no current whatsoever, there are no currents in it. And the reason is that even though there's great temperature underneath there, there is no convection. And for convection, you have to have something lower down, being lower density, and rising up. Now, what actually happens is that density it really has. So you've got the density of the gas. Well, the gas is really, really highly compressed. 160 times the density of water easily. It's really compressed. So you can imagine it's greater than the density of steel in the sun when you get down to this layer. And so it's gas, but it's not liquid. You know, it's much closer to a solid. It's a plasma, but its density and the fact that it's not moving, it would look, if you look at it, you'd say it was a solid. And this is quite an important thing. Now, there are two things which make something less dense. And there's one thing is how much you're pushing it together. So if you've got a piece of paper and you crush it together, it goes from a light ball to a more dense ball. The other thing is temperature. So you know that if you heat air or heat a balloon or heat water, it expands and it is less dense and it tends to float. So in the suns, in fact all suns, there's this competition between the pressure of the rock, the sun above it, pushing down and compressing. So if it can compress sufficiently fast, it will actually beat the uncompression or the expansion due to temperature. So in this zone, you have basically, it's called a radiation zone, but really that's a misnomer. It's a mistake which has come in because there's really sort of free space radiation and solid radiation. And solid radiation is what we call conduction. So the sun is really almost a hot rock from 0 to 70 units out. There's no movement whatsoever. Because as you go down, the pressure increases so much that the density always increases, regardless of the actual temperature increase. And the temperature is increasing up to 15 million degrees in the center, but this is not sufficient to make the density lighter and get this beautiful boiling effect. So the sun is not boiling in the center. Even though the heat source is there, it's not boiling. If you imagine it's like a giant hot plate and nothing's happening, the energy is coming out, but there's no boiling. So this is a beautiful solid layer. So from 0 to 70, it's solid. Then from 70 up to 100, you do have solar weather. Things are boiling. It's very turbulent. There's basically a huge storm front happening, and you have these bands of weather, wind zones on Earth, whipping around the sun faster. So you've got the central solid core of the sun, or solid center of the sun, from 70 to 0, and it's rotating at a certain rate. And at the equator, the wind at the surface is rotating much more quickly. And at the poles, it's rotating less fast. So on average, it's keeping up, but the weather is doing some wild things. Now, if you can imagine a wind, if you're actually in a hang glider in the wind, you can't feel the same strength as if you're actually standing as a little person on the land surface. You suddenly feel the wind because the land is holding you still and the wind's rushing past you. And this is true for this interface layer. Now, this interface layer where the winds or the plasma suddenly changes speed violently is called the tachocline. Tacho means speed and cline means a transition zone. So, this transition zone, there's a huge shear force on the plasma. Now, this huge shear force generates a huge magnetic field. A magnetic field so big that it actually creates the magnetic field for the entire sun. There's two components to this field. One is the field as you imagine it coming out. But there's another field which wraps around the sun, which is tightly held. Now, this is the same mechanism for our Earth. So we have an absolute solid core, a liquid turbulent layer. And in this turbulent layer, in the inner and outer core, our magnetic field is generated. So too for Jupiter. It also has it there. And it also has a radiation generation. So if you're traveling to Jupiter, you have to actually travel through its magnetic field. So magnetic field radiation, we've got to link those two ideas together. But the great thing about this is that the Earth's magnetic field guards us from the sun's mighty magnetic field. Now, we have to go up, and I want to take a pause a moment to actually think what the sun looks like. Now, if we look at everything but the sun, as we do in a solar eclipse, we'll see something called the corona, the crown of the sun. So it does look to us that the sun is crowned with this beautiful radiant lines or paintbrush strokes of light travelling, firing away from it. And indeed, it is firing away. And you'd say, oh, I wonder what that is like. And it looks like a wind blowing away. And you wouldn't be wrong. But if you want to get another sense of a wind, imagine a birthday candle at your birthday, and it's blowing there, and you blow it. You can see the flame turn and the smoke blow away. So too, we do have birthday candles in space coming into the sun, showing us the strength of the solar wind, and they are none other than the comets. So as the comet comes into the sun, it smokes or creates steam, and we see the steam blown back by the solar wind at sometimes huge distances, like the distance between Venus and the Earth. So these very large distances of this, the solar wind is very evident. And indeed, the solar wind, the gas blowing away, is so violent that if you lose your magnetic field, The solar wind will blow your atmosphere away. And this has happened for Mars. Mars had a magnetic field. I think the theory is that it had an impact and it shut its beautiful dynamo down. It's a slightly smaller planet. And the solar wind has blown the atmosphere of Mars away. And so for the moon, there was sometimes a small atmosphere on the moon, not a sufficient magnetic field, is blown away. The Earth has been spared in that case. And the closer you're in, the more fierce the solar wind is. And this is unfortunate to people who travel in space beyond Earth's protective magnetic field, who have to endure the solar wind. So what's actually happening with the solar wind? How is this 5,000 degrees surface? Okay, it's hot, but if you see a really hot radiator, you can see things which are 5,000 degrees on Earth. It's anything that's white hot, but when you go up to it, it's not blowing in your face. What's going on here? And this is where we get back to the magnetic field, and it sort of brings the story hopefully to the close. So you have this strong magnetic field generating, if you like, a huge lightning bolts ripping through the sun, continuous lightning bolts, thousands of amps going through the sun, and these are held together, pinched together, magnetic field lines, and these have been driven by this rotation of the solar core and the outer reaches the sun. So that's from 69, you get the tachosphere at 70, and then it changes to great turbulence. And this turbulence is driven by the temperature, the buoyancy, the heat, which has taken a million years to travel from the core to the 70 point. It has a fast ride on thermal currents up to the outer atmosphere of the sun. And you can see the sun boiling these little points. Now, we just before we go, let's look at the heat transport in a solid. And this is what it is. It's not radiation in space, because the light travels from one atom to the next, or one nucleus to the next, as it's in the sun. And so there is actually no radiation. Radiation within a solid is how that solid conducts thermal energy. So, for instance, if you were to heat up a river stone, or a stone in a fire, and break it open, you'd see that inside it's full of light, and the light is actually transmitting very slowly inside. And that internal radiation in the solid we call conduction. Now, conduction in a metal, they've got another path through the electrons, but in something like the sun, the transmission is very, very slow. So it's slow and very orderly, then reaches this order layer, creates this huge magnetic field as you get this transition turbulence. And this magnetic field creates these large bundles of field lines with thrashing about within the sun. Now, if you've ever been to a science display, a Tesla display, you'll hear the actual lightning vibrate. Now, some of the vibration is due to the actual formation, the way there's oscillation of the electronics. But it's a Tesla coil is a high frequency hollow core transformer. That's all it is. But you can actually hear a lightning bolt. You can hear that bang of electricity. In fact, you can hear it now. Some of that bar is to do with the actual that you hear is to do with the actual way that it's generated. But in general, in the sun, these huge bolts of electricity vibrate. And this vibration, if you like, is called Alphane waves. And these waves interact with the plasma, pick them up and actually accelerate the ions. So the atmosphere just outside the sun is actually being heated by magnetic induction or microwave induction. It's a bit like a giant microwave. And this grabs particles and absolutely rips them out and heats them up. In fact, if you look at the corona, look at the spectroscope, you can actually pick off what the temperature is. And the temperature you normally pick off is from little transitions of neutral atoms and ions. And so there's a transition there, and you can see that, there's a few degrees, but it's actually millions of degrees, 10 million degrees. And this microwave cooking actually cooks the surface of the sun. This has two effects, this heating of the sun. So you can actually look at the spectra and see highly charged ions, iron 3, things which have multiple electrons stripped away from them, because they're so energetic that the electrons get ripped away from it. So you know it's very high temperature. But this has two effects. One is that it thins the atmosphere very quickly, and you can actually makes it easy to see through. So you can actually see a certain depth into the sun, and you can see up to the depth of where it's at the photosphere. That's the photosphere means where the light comes from. That's around 5,000 degrees. Now, as this mechanism dies, the sun's temperature or energy output is still the same, but it walks to a larger radius, a lower temperature, and a larger star, a larger redder star, which is putting out more energy over a larger surface area, but at a lower temperature. So this is how you get, as this process dies, you get, it swells to a red giant. This process slows down. And the interesting thing is that the larger the star, the more aggressive this process is. So a larger star, the actual, is a larger volume, but in terms of the scale of the star, you may actually get, say a blue giant, the actual transition zone of the tachosphere will be around 95%, but the speed transition, the strength of the magnetic field will be such that the actual generation will be much more efficient, the magnetic field will be much stronger, and the actual heating process will be greater. And so in a bigger star, you get a greater magnetic field and a greater digging down to the surface of the star. Now, the other aspect of this is the solar wind blowing away. Now, we have a high energy, but very faint solar wind. Small dwarf stars actually have a low energy, but a greater, stronger solar wind. So your small star like Centauri Proxima, our nearest star, is a small red star. This will have a strong wind. So people say, well, there's a planet around it. Well, that planet will endure very strong solar wind. So it's going to be harder for life to evolve on it. This process, this microwave effect, blows away the surface of the star. And the remarkable thing is that we are actually orbiting within the atmosphere of our sun. That is right. The sun has got its very thin atmosphere and it's blowing out. And the actual surface of our sun, and we can possibly see it from space, is way beyond our furthest planet, up beyond Neptune and Jupiter. There's something called the helopause. This is where the atmosphere of the sun meets the pressure of gas in the galaxy. And the same sort of thing happens for on a larger scale for the galaxy. So our sun is punching a protective bubble around as it goes. Now this bubble, you say, oh, this is, I can't believe it. But if you look at a new star which is born into a nebula, you can see this bright star and a bubble around it where it's actually started to blow gas around. So one of the important things is that the sun, because it's got this structure of a solid core, when I say core, this is from 70% down to 20%, I mean that solid section of the sun beneath the tachyocline. Because it's got that, it's generating this gas around it, this blowing gas around. And this is very important because if you've got this accretion of gas, this is gas falling in, this process starts to blow further gas coming in. So it can, sort of as the star lights up, it can actually stop further material, the actual growth of the sun. Now, the important thing is that our sun has moved away from its stellar nursery, so it's moved out of the zone where it was getting a lot of gas before when it was building up. But this process actually starts to actually conserve mass. It means that the mass doesn't all fall together into one large sun. You get suns as they light up. They say that's enough. It's almost like animals eating into the interstellar gas, the star formation. So I hope people have found this interesting. I've tried to explain it, and I'm just still walking on my cardiac walk. It's pretty hard, I can tell you. Okay, well, thanks a lot, and I'll try and see how this sounds and try and improve my explanations in time. It's a very, very fascinating time. I suppose I want to say it's a very easy thing to understand and explain, but people have left a few traps. People just don't discuss the solar wind. They don't discuss comets. They, I suppose, muck up what is the temperature of suns. You know, why it is, they have this very simplistic view. And if you say, well, why does size matter? It's something that sort of, you know, why does a greater size, surely the sun will actually be bigger still and hotter. Why is it blue? They just brush you off. And finally, they just read from the textbook that the energy coming from the core up to that 70% point is about radiation. And when you really dig into it and you understand it, it's not radiation as we understand it from a light bulb or a heater. It's much closer to conduction. So these sets of traps, and people who really haven't understood it, teaching it, mean that really no one understands or appreciates the actual beauty of our solar system and the danger that we want to go. One of the things I want to just say before closing is something that I heard from my father, who was a scientist who was working with people in the Apollo program. And there was this report back which didn't get to the general public. I don't know whether it is true. However, once you got out of the Earth's protective magnetic field and flew to the moon, the astronauts experienced something called high Z radiation. And I must stress, I don't know whether it's true. I've not heard this a second time. But this is particles, those very highly ionized particles, iron and other things which are falling to the sun. They get radiated and accelerated in this oscillating microwave magnetic field, which fires it out as a super accelerator. So this is why you get accelerated particles. It's the oscillation of that magnetic field coming from the sun. It's not a nuclear reaction. It's not a kinetic process. It's a truly a genuine accelerated process. You get these ions, and these are called high Z particles. And there's not too many of them, but they do rush through. And it was told to me, I'm not sure, it sounds as though it would be true, that when the Z particle actually went through the astronaut's vitreous humor, it made it glow. So they would see these little sparks when they closed their eyes. They'd see these little blips of light as the high Z particles went through their eye and scintillated and caused light to be formed within their eye and register it. Now, I haven't heard that since, but that gives you some sort of idea of the dreadful radiation that you receive if you go into space. And good luck to people traveling to Mars. It's going to be a hell of a journey with the, it's sort of like a journey in a microwave oven, which is our solar system. So that's a good 45 minutes. It's a long podcast. So thanks for listening. And I'm only doing this so long because it's such a long, hard cardiac work. Thanks for listening. In the meantime, keep on doing science.